Okay, thank you for your attendance. Can we draw the meeting to order? Any apologies?
Any apologies from Councillors Coventry and Devinck, Chair.
And our apologies for Kenny Young and Russell Imrie and Brian Pottinger. Any declarations of interest at this stage? Okay, item four, minutes of the meetings of the 25th of November. Any?
Yep.
Jim?
Yep, Chair, the minutes of the performance meeting held that day, on page three, down the bottom, the decisions to note comments to Audit Scotland in relation to the committee's scrutiny role in this matter, and therefore to receive information from officers on the timeline of reports. We were asking for information on what information councillors were given on this subject and what time, what was agreed by Cabinet, etc. I'm just wondering what progress is on producing that information.
I'll have to get back to you on that one, Councillor. That was with Kevin Anderson. I'll check with him, and I can either get back to Councillor Muirhead or to all members of the committee, which, as you prefer.
Well, it was a committee that asked, so I think it's when that information is available, it should go to all members. But it'd be helpful, I think, just to an email to each of them to indicate what progress we've had in getting that information drawn together.
Okay. On the 26th of November in the morning and the 26th of November in the afternoon. Are we happy with the correct record? Okay, thank you. Item 5 is the first statutory biodiversity report performance. We have with us and welcome Jamie Bryant along, and thank you for attending, Jim. And I take it Ian will be the advisor for today. Could I hand over to yourselves to see if you have anything to say as an opener before throwing it open to the Lions?
Well, thanks for the invitation. As I understood it, I'm here to answer some questions. I don't really have a statement as such.
Okay, thanks, James. Okay, guys, can I throw it open to questions? Ian?
Yeah, thank you, Derek. Yes, I've long been concerned and have expressed my opinion that we really need to have at least the role of biodiversity officer. I appreciate in the current financial constraints that it perhaps doesn't need to be a full-time role, but it has to be somebody who has this role as a priority within their portfolio. I'm particularly concerned that we've just gone through the process of developing a local plan. A lot of work's gone into that. We had quite a few staff dedicated to the production of that proposal. And yet, within the proposed local plan, it stressed sustainable growth. Now, sustainable growth involves a good deal of consideration for sustainability, and biodiversity is part of that. So I was very surprised to hear that we didn't have anybody, to my knowledge, who was given the role of scrutinising the proposals before they came to council with a view to incorporating biodiversity within that principle of sustainability. I'd like to ask, therefore, why we didn't afford what I believe to be adequate priority to biodiversity within the production of the local plan.
Well, there's no plans at the moment to appoint such an officer, and I'm quite happy that the officers are doing what they're required to do statutorily. We could do more, but I'm quite happy with the way things are going. However, there's going to be a reorganisation in planning, as you know, and during that reorganisation, Ian Johnson will be looking at the possibility of a post. I'm not saying that it's going to happen, but that will come up during this discussion.
Thank you, Derek. My point is not what we plan to do, but we've, as I say, we've just gone through an exercise to produce a local plan which lays out the foundation for how Midlothian is going to go forward in terms of development over the next 10 to 20 years. And in that respect, we should really have made sure that that development over those two decades incorporates recognition and preparation for biodiversity within Midlothian, and we haven't done it.
Chair, the situation with the local plan, and I appreciate Councillor Baxter's comments. The local plan, being a statutory document, does require to have an environmental report to accompany it, which does need scrutiny in itself. What I would say about the local plan is that, in terms of, does the local plan provide a basis for sustainable development, and does it focus in the relevant places on matters such as biodiversity, green networks, opportunities, and does it safeguard, in terms of new development proposals, does it safeguard, as far as can be managed, the environmental impact? I would say yes, it does. It's a document which is prepared by primarily by one of the officers in the team who does have a degree of expertise and, in relation to such matters, but also it's subject to external scrutiny through the likes of Scottish Natural Heritage. I think in summary, the situation with the local plan is it is there as a plan which can take things forward, but I would accept that the delivery of that and maintaining the progress on that does need a level of resource, and currently that is stretched. As Councillor Bryant indicated, and it may help the committee, as following the restructuring arrangements with following through the management review, we now have appointed a single planning manager for within the service to replace the two managers who were there previously. So the new planning manager is Peter Arnstorff, who was appointed last week. I'm looking to work with Peter on looking now at the single planning service, and certainly from an officer point of view, it's helpful to have from the committee here a clear indication that some attention needs to be paid as part of that review to ensuring we have a level of resource which is commensurate with the needs in relation to biodiversity.
Thank you. Thank you for your responses. Moving on from the local plan and leaving aside the future plans, which we don't know, whether they'll come to fruition in the manner in which you suggest, looking at operationally how we manage biodiversity just now, I'd like to ask what day-to-day work is done on, for example, planning applications which come forward. There have been a few instances where, as a member of the local review body, I've thought that there should have been input from a biodiversity officer. It's not a great deal of time. I'm not suggesting this is a full-time role, but at least somebody should be casting their eye over planning applications and reviews and giving us advice as councillors, either on the planning committee or on the local review body, to be able to make a judgment as to the impact of particular applications on biodiversity. And I'm not just talking about statutory requirements. I can think of one or two examples where immature woodland, for example, was to be removed, and this doesn't have an impact on any statutory requirements that the council has. There were no species, for example, that were resident in those areas which needed to be protected, but at the same time it is part of, if you like, a jigsaw across the whole of Midlothian. There are areas which, if you take, for example, green belts and green wedges, which is a current debate which is going on, my own preference is for green wedges, because in green belts you tend to have an area where wildlife cannot flow freely in or out. So if a planning application comes forward for a plot of land which is perhaps not protected, it's not in the green belt, it's not designated as being anything other than for development, but at the same time will have an impact on biodiversity because perhaps it's part of a corridor to allow wildlife to flow in and out to another area. Is somebody looking at this kind of implication of any planning applications?
Chair, this is a technical question specifically on resources, operational resources. I'm happy to answer that. Obviously, Councillor Bryant may wish to add to it. But in terms of the position where we are, we have a service level agreement with the Wildlife Information Centre, TWIC as it's colloquially known. And among the tasks that we agree with them that they do is they screen all planning applications that come in and advise us on any that they think they need to have referred to them and which need further attention. I fully understand that the first port of call for that is looking at the statutory designations, and clearly that's an area where we must ensure that we are doing the right thing, otherwise we can fall foul of the Act, and I'm confident about that. I do accept that there will be instances whereby maybe a greater understanding of local knowledge or a particular understanding of the circumstances of a certain site would suggest that it should have more scrutiny than it may get. And certainly, I would hope that we could start to move to arrangements whereby we would have that higher level of scrutiny so that such applications didn't come through and provide concerns of that nature.
Would a way to deal with that now be if we don't have a specific biodiversity officer? Are there no courses available that, you know, it's always better to have people with a general knowledge that can, you know, if they're looking at planning applications, can take that into consideration as a matter of course in their daily activity. Are there courses that existing planning officers could be sent on that would give them enough of an understanding on the biodiversity issues to allow them to make these kind of judgments, you know, right across the board, rather than have somebody almost looking at it as an afterthought?
Chair, that's absolutely right. And indeed, the discussion I'm going to be having with the new planning manager is taking the opportunity now to provide some greater degree of breadth to the way in which the officers work. As you know, to some extent, they're very, very specific in terms of the tasks that they undertake. So the sort of review we're looking at is not a question of coming back to members and asking for lots more money for lots more planning officers. That's not the purpose of what the review, but it's looking to use the existing resource much more effectively. In answer to the question, yes, there are training courses to increase awareness and knowledge and understanding of issues to do with historic conservation, to do with nature conservation, etc., to do with biodiversity. So that's the sort of approach which, you know, I'm going to be looking at to try and upskill, awful word, but to upskill people, the existing officers, to provide that better approach. But also, I think there obviously is room there, because of the nature of the way I'm thinking about these things, to have somebody as well within the existing resource who perhaps also has a more dedicated role in this and maybe another matter that the committee is going to come on to talk about shortly.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on this subject? Okay. Can we then move on to item 6, is the Scotland Climate Change Declaration. Jam, I take it it'll just be the same questions. You didn't have an opening statement? No. Okay, thank you. Can I just simply throw it open to questions? Ian, I understand you were the main participant here, so I'll let you in first.
Thank you, Derek. Yes, I was extremely disappointed at the Council's response to the COSLA on this, particularly as it was welcomed by Cabinet as being a good document. I found it absolutely atrocious. As I stated at the time, that to say that the main achievement of the council leader was to take part in Tough Mudder to publicise Earth Hour, having himself proposed Cald Hall open cast mine should be passed, which is many, many times more destructive than people switching off the lights at night. I was disappointed that biodiversity is now incorporated with the climate change and sustainable development within the council. It again seems to be downgrading there. That some of the things I picked up from the document were that managing a reduction in governance seemed to be among the priorities for the year ahead. The points I made at the time, it emitted figures showing that Midlothian's emissions increased in 2012 rather than going down. Failed to mention the Council's decision to improve the mine at Cald Hall would make it impossible to meet the Council's target for reducing emissions. Had no clear plan for how the Council will meet its target of reducing carbon emissions per head of population to 2.5 tonnes a year by 2020. It relies almost entirely on national and regionally driven projects rather than the Council's own efforts to demonstrate progress, It has no plan for promoting renewable energy in Midlothian, although I should say that I'm working on that with my colleagues and the council, and hopefully that will change. It shows little effort to make use of skills and experience in community groups in Midlothian, making practical efforts to combat climate change. But overall, I would say that the main failing of this document is that nowhere within the future risks did it mention Cold Hall at all, which will really blow out of the water any attempts we make in any other respect to reducing carbon emissions within the county. I just wonder how you react to that.
Before I hand over to Ian, I'll just make a couple of comments. I noticed you mentioned Owen Thompson's Tough Mudder, but the paragraph before it, beneath it, Midlothian was a winner of the Scottish National Renewables League Award. You never mentioned that. Cold Hall hasn't even started yet, so I don't think that's a factor at the moment. Well, I'll hand you over to Ian just now.
Just on the issue of the planning application, clearly matters relating to impact on the environment, both locally and on a wider scale, are material considerations and would have been taken into account as part of the assessment of the application. But the starting point for the assessment of the planning application is the development plan, and any material considerations that can affect what the position is on the local plan. So to some extent the issue of any one particular issue can only have a certain amount of weight in the consideration by the planning authority of an application. So I've just mentioned that as a way of just tempering, in a sense, the way in which these issues were considered as part of the application for Cold Hall Moor.
Yeah, just before I bring anybody in, I wasn't at the last meeting, and I wonder if you could maybe just refresh us on what your concerns are with Cold Hall and how that will, what will add to the emissions.
Well, the climate change declaration, as opposed to the carbon management plan within the council, addresses the production of carbon by everybody within Midlothian, not just the council. So Cold Hall is relevant to that, although not relevant to the carbon management plan. Now, at the end of that document, I don't have it in front of me, I'm afraid, possibly as a result of climate change, my window in my office blew open and all the papers have gone missing. I can't find anything. But my recollection was that there was a point at the end of the document which said that which should include all known future threats and risks to managing the carbon dioxide production within the county by everyone. Now, I cannot conceivably see why Cold Hall should have been omitted from that, even though it's not started yet. It's been passed, it has planning permission, it could go ahead tomorrow. We don't know, but it is a risk, it is a threat. And that was the main point I was making.
Alec.
Chair, just, I wasn't at the last meeting either, so I didn't take part in the debate. But I didn't understand where Councillor Baxter's coming from, that Cold Hall Muir will cause a problem with carbon emissions, because as far as I'm aware, and I've worked in the coal industry all my life, the extraction of coal doesn't cause carbon emissions. It's the burning it that causes carbon emissions. And where we should be tackling the problem isn't on extracting open cast coal at Cold Hall Muir, but it's the burning it at the Long Annet Power Station. And if you really want to address carbon emissions, then we should be looking for carbon capture at Long Annet Power Station and no try to stop the extraction of coal at Cold Hall Muir.
Yeah, well, if it hadn't been for the UK government stopping carbon capture at Long Annet, then we might have been well on our road to being to the forefront doing the carbon capture from our coal-fired power stations. But again, the UK government put a halt to it, withdrawing funding for it, and then put a tax on the oil companies.
Look, Chair, I don't want to get involved in this debate. The energy companies in Britain are no longer in public ownership, and I'm quite sure Councillor Wallace should be aware of that. It's the companies that should be addressing carbon capture. And I'm not saying there shouldn't be government help. to assist them on it. And there was talk about building a new carbon catcher power station at Grangemouth, which would be an opportunity to open up Long Garnet Mine again. Whether that goes ahead, I don't care. I don't know what will happen, because the energy situation in the world now is in a mess. And it's not a mess with the UP government. It's in a mess because of free market capitalism. I mean, the aisle, whether Colomira go ahead, I don't know, because the prices are at rock bottom. Good for us, by the way. Good for me when I fill my car up. But it's no good for the industry in general.
Ian.
Thank you, Chair. Just to put a lid on this discussion about carbon capture and storage, I don't think there's anywhere in the world where it's been proven yet to work. Even where, if it were to work, and there are lots of ifs and buts, it's been estimated that an extra 30% of coal would have to be burnt to produce the same amount of output energy if you incorporate carbon capture and storage. So the benefits are not as great as they're made out to be.
Yeah, okay.
We're kind of getting off the subject going into this. The fact is that I think what Ian was questioning was that issue wasn't highlighted as a risk. The paper was accepted by Cabinet, thought it was a good paper. That wasn't a risk, but I don't know if Ian can help here, but I'm trying to get my head around this as well. What is the... Alec was saying that there's no carbon impact on digging the coal. What should have been in that paper regarding the impact of coal toll? What is the impact, in your opinion, of the coal toll open cast?
Well, I don't know what the technicalities, I don't know whether it should have been or shouldn't have been, but it is a risk to meeting Scotland's carbon emissions targets, certainly, and therefore should have been stated. Not quantified, I agree that perhaps in terms of the amount produced in Midlothian, it would be low. But in terms of meeting the overall objectives of the Scottish Government, and that is why COSLA asked for all councils to provide that estimate, it would be unfair if the council area, Fife, as it were, Long Gannet is, would have to take on the responsibility of trying to mitigate the extra risks implied by Cald Hall. We are adding to them by producing fuel which is going to be used in another part of Scotland. It's Scotland's targets that this paper is ultimately addressing.
Okay, can I just let Joe in? Joe's tried to get in, but I think on the same subject.
Well, again, we have to go back to the UK style of government, because we can't call them elected members, but the unelected House of Lords removed powers from the Scottish government on energy consumption and how we have our energy programme running in Scotland. I think you should be maybe going and writing to Lord Jeremy Purvis and ask him these questions, because he voted to take these powers away from the Scottish government. No, a by your leave or a phone call or anything. Totally unelected people. We can't get rid of them, and they make decisions that affect Scotland. And you come here asking this wee council about coal toll moor, as Alex says. There's no carbon emission coming from digging the coal. And then the UK government stopped us using carbon capture. And they see a problem here.
Jamie, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention the carbon capture in this document here, Scottish Climate Change Declaration. Midlothian, since 2006-07, has reduced its carbon footprint from 35,000 tonnes down to 26,000 tonnes. So we're doing okay.
Can I let Jim back in first, Ian? Because I think I think there was a follow-up question there, was is if we weren't digging the coal here in Midlothian, would there not be a higher carbon emission to the world by the transporting it from Canada, Poland, Siberia, wherever it's coming from? So sort of worldwide, I'm kind of lost here how it's just digging it in Midlothian would be our risk. I would have thought you'd have had to take a global look at these things, because you're probably better transporting it for Rosebell to Long Garnet as for Siberia to Long Garnet here.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, this is a common argument which is made, for example, that fracked gas is cleaner than coal, and yes, it is. But it's like saying that methadone is better than heroin. You ultimately, we should be trying to come off the drug rather than move into one which is deemed safer. You could take the argument to a further level and say that by abolishing, by Mrs. Thatcher getting rid of a lot of manufacturing in the UK, then we've cut our carbon emissions substantially, but all we've done is we've moved them to China, and then we have to transport the goods halfway across the world. So, you know, you can play with figures, but ultimately what we should be looking at is what Midlothian is doing to help reduce the amount of carbon dioxide produced throughout the whole of Scotland, not just looking at within our borders, but what we can control, and call to all this something that we can control. Just going back to what Jamie was saying, are we doing enough? I would say we, and I don't just mean Midlothian, but Scotland, UK, globally, we're not doing enough. If we're to keep within 2 degrees centigrade limit of climate, of global warming, as the IPCC say is safe, we can only produce 550 gigatons of carbon dioxide globally. We've got five times that on the books for all the known explored fossil fuels which haven't been extracted yet. So if we're to stay within that safe limit, 80% of that has got to stay in the ground. No more exploring, no tax benefits for companies that are going exploring. 80% of what we've discovered has to go in the ground. So, Jamie, no, we're not doing enough. We're not doing anywhere near enough.
Okay, any other questions? Ian?
Just one less contentious one. At that last meeting, and I think you referred to it before, the council had received an award for its solar panels on council houses. I think was that the one you were referring to, because I asked at the last meeting if we could have figures on the numbers of council houses, because I think it's an excellent project and something which I think the council is trying and is to a certain extent exceeding in leading on this, and I would like to see this extended to a far greater number. But I have no idea at the moment what percentage of new council houses and the existing council houses, particularly, we have solar panels on. I'd be grateful for that answer. Thanks.
I take it Naimda has that information with them. From my memory, I think wherever we could put solar panels on, we were putting them on. There were certain areas where we couldn't, they were facing the wrong way. Sorry, I'm not up to speed on this, but I can remember at some meetings that the directions of the houses that had not been suitable. You'll probably kind of be a bit more than me, but I'm sure we can get Gary Sherritt's team to pass on that information. Is there any other questions on this issue? Ian or Jamie, do you want to say anything in finishing? No. No. Okay, could I thank you very much for coming along and giving up your time to give us some answers today. Thank you. Can we move on to item 7, is the inspection of Cornbank St James Primary School nursery class. Mary.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. This is the report of the inspection. The inspection was carried out in October 2014. Councillor Pottinger has asked that we put school numbers and capacities on reports, which is why we've got the numbers and the capacities on there just now. The school occupancy rate is nearly 72%. The nursery is 100% full at 2020, but at the end of January, the new extension will be open, and that's offering 30 places. In 2.2, it shows you the grades that were evaluated by the inspectors, all of the areas were good, apart from the improvement through self-evaluation, which was satisfactory. In section 2.4, the report outlines areas for improvement, and in section 3, the inspectors concluded that they were satisfied with the school's overall quality of provision, and they were confident that the school's self-evaluation processes would lead to improvements, and as a result, they would make no further visits. In section 5, the recommendations are the Cabinet's asked to note the content of the report, congratulate the pupils, staff connected with the report, and note whilst acknowledging progress reflected in this report that we will continue to challenge, support and monitor the service.
Thanks, Mary. Comments, questions? None. I'm going to say, from my point of view, Mary, is that whilst it's an acceptable report, I'm not actually sure, and I think we've discussed this before, where we were happy with goods and satisfactory, especially when you can have, if I mind right, very good and excellence in these reports. And to be honest, if my memory serves me right, St James Primary School sort of has a reasonably high level catchment area, so it would be good to sort of see us trying to push, and we did sort of say that we would try to be looking for very goods and excellence in these. But however, there's nothing sort of standing out here that's wrong, but it's maybe worth making the point that we did some time ago say that we would endeavour to come away from goods to get to very goods and excellence. Jim?
Aye, part of the role of this committee is obviously to be encouraging, but also to be looking to press ahead and you know, improve things. One of the things that strikes me sometimes, and I know there's often a long time between reports, but to know what direction a school is moving in might be quite helpful as well. I don't know when the last report was done on this, but you know, how does it compare? I suppose one of the problems with doing that is that regimes change, methods change, and the presentation of results can change. So it might not be meaningful enough to do that. But I just wondered if any consideration had ever been given to giving information from previous reports, just to, so that we can compare, if it's possible, to compare the direction.
The difficulty with that is that, as you talk about regime changes, different methods of inspection, but also the time between inspections. So it can be up to 5 years in a primary school setting. Equally, we're challenging about this report. The report is okay, but it's not good enough. And there's work ongoing with the school group managers to support the head in improvements. The head and the deputy were devastated that they got a satisfactory, and that's good in a way that, you know, that it's about continuous improvement. It's about how we can support them to improve. And the school group managers work very closely with all of our schools on that. Councillor Thompson's asked us to do the same thing that you're asking for. Can we have a look at broadly over the last few years how things have changed? So we're going to pull that together and try and make it meaningful, because there's different regimes. And then, of course, if you throw in the care inspectorate that also inspects nurseries, then it can be more complex. But we're going to try and pull something together.
Okay. Are we satisfied with the report? We agree with the recommendations. Okay, and thank you for your attendance.